Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The date today is October 7th, 2025. Obviously a significant date. And this is episode 553. I'm the host, Mark Ames, in the Greater Rochester area of Western New York. You're listening to Radio Warner. Subscribe and support the show. Go to patreon.com/Radio Warner and subscribe, please. And I'm online. He's back with the Warner, a.k.a. John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Bretcher, back home, rested, recovered, and ready for battle. John, how you doing?
Well, I like the three R's alliteration, but, you know, not quite ready. More like... recovering, yeah. But as most listeners will know, maybe I had a bad fall, a syncope, which is, I know as a rhetorical figure, like, you know, when you suddenly break off speech, like in Tolkien, where they say, drums in the deep, drums out. and that's the last you hear from them. But I had a syncope, as in... after driving over to the boot part of the boot heel. We're in the boot heel now in Puglia, but we drove over to Calabria, and we were looking at some real estate. And it was just strange because, I figure... the U.S. is heading for the rocks at full speed, and whatever money we have, we might be better off putting it in a very cheap property somewhere in Italy than crashing into the rocks with our native economy. But, you know, nobody knew anything about these properties that were advertised, and they didn't seem particularly eager to see us. So we ended up walking around this small town named Cosenza, and finding no interest at all these real estate places. And it was a warm day. I'd driven a long, long way. You got to be alert on, you know, southern Italian roads every second. So I went into a grocery store with Catherine, and Catherine was getting some stuff, and I said, God, I feel tired. And the next thing I heard was far off a dull thud, which was the back of my head hitting the concrete floor. And you always feel embarrassed if you've got enough strength to feel embarrassed.
Yeah.
But this time it was like, nope, I've slammed the back of my head. And also all the parts of my body on the way down felt awful. I knew something was bad, like ribs were not good, you know, joints were not good. I'm old, you know, and you can't fall like you used to.
Yeah.
So I waited for the ambulance guys to take me to...
how long were you out for, do you know? Or were you out?
No, I don't... I've never been out for more than a couple of seconds.
Okay.
Which is a mixed blessing because sometimes you wake up and something's broken and you let out this scream that is like nothing on earth. But I've never been really knocked out for more than a second. And
like in a boxing match, sort of, if you sort of amateur boxed and you get knocked out, it's like a split second, but it's also a lifetime in a way.
Yeah.
But in real time, it's a split second.
I actually tried some of that boxing stuff, and I didn't have any particular talent except that fatal talent, which is known as a good chin. I was capable of absorbing a lot of punishment, which was a dumb thing to do. And so I just let them take me to the local hospital. And that was quite an experience. They said basically the Cuban neurologists, and there was a lot of Cuban medical staff.
That's so interesting. I mean, because the Cubans usually go to sort of friendly socialist global South countries to help out. I mean, they're very well known and they have a very good, you know, they have great doctors, great healthcare for a country that's, you know, so poor. And they're very generous with it. So it's strange that they're in southern Italy, though. That's interesting.
Yeah, well, it's a pretty comfortable place. And it's not that prosperous even now. You know, it's also, I think, a leftist place because at one point as they were they were pushing me into the room to have an EEG, the Italian nurse told me that we have a lot of Cubans here. We don't like Americans. we like Cubans. And she raised her fist and I went, yeah, me too.
No kidding. Go Castro.
Yeah. The Cubans just sort of stolidly let that talk go. But there was one male nurse who clearly didn't like me. I don't know if he was Cuban or Italian, but he just didn't like me because they put us in this horrible waiting room for the first night. And that was a little traumatic. Catherine, to her eternal credit, sat with me in the waiting room. And it was a long night. People would, I remember one woman who was wheeled in a wheelchair, just vomiting into a cardboard box that she was carrying. There were people in the distance yelling, "Aiuta, aiuta me!"
And help then, me, help me. Yeah,
yeah, and other people just yelling, "Ah!" And I knew this from other hospital stays. Like, there's something about even heavy anesthetics that leave you with pain when the blood pumps, like once a second or so. And so they just yell, "Ah, ah," when it peaks like that. And we had that all night because the hospital was vastly overcrowded. I don't quite know why, but underfunded probably and overcrowded. So eventually they pushed me into, I mean, still in bed because they don't want me to move. They pushed me into a dead-end corridor. And I lay there for a couple of days, and nobody would listen to my pleas, like, "Please give me some pills so that I don't panic so much," because I tend to panic in hospitals. And eventually, you know, I guess you're reconciled to it, and I just lay there, but when Catherine would come back, because they kicked her out after the first night,
they kicked her out, so you were alone?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And you were in a room or you're in a corridor still?
Corridor.
God.
Yeah. Everybody was in the corridor. They were all lined. There was no more space.
I've seen this. I've seen this in a local hospital when we had to go in for an emergency. It happens. It happens, and it happens more in emergency care, you know, more poor places, but it's not uncommon, you know.
Yeah. I mean, nobody else seemed very fazed by it, but I was getting a little nervous, and they did a second EEG, and I had the feeling from their reaction, because, you know, they were guarded the way medical people always are, and they won't tell you anything. But I had the feeling that it was good, that though there had been blood in the brain leaking the first time, there was not the second time. So that afternoon, like 3 days after I hit the floor, Catherine visited me and we just walked out together. And Annibale, God bless him, somehow reached out to one of the doctors at this hospital, because Annibale is at the opposite end of Italy, but he's a very loyal friend and very well connected, knows how to get things done, which I certainly do not. And he reached out to this doctor who came and saw us at this hotel in Cosenza, where we were staying. And, you know, my first 2 days in that hotel had just been sleeping nonstop, because I don't think I actually slept much in that
in the corridor. It's got to be light. There's sound everywhere. Even if you're catching 10 minutes or 20 minutes here and there of sleep, you're not sleeping.
No.
Like, yeah.
No. And there was quite a lot of pain, because, as I said, I sort of collapsed. You can faint in a lot of ways, you know, slow motion, or in this case, very fast motion, like a puppet whose strings have been cut. And I just collapsed in a heap. And when that happens, your ribs often meet your knees very hard. And I either had broken ribs, or I don't know, the synovia may have just been swollen, because I know that happens sometimes. Like, the x-ray will not show any broken bones, but, you know, I know something's wrong in there. And
well, there's tendons in there. I mean, even bruised ribs is not like a bruise anywhere else. It is.
No.
It's like broken ribs. So there's a
and
lot.
And of course, I coughed because I picked up a bad cold the hospital. And, you know, coughing in those conditions is not good. It's like,
yes.
Oh. So, you know, it was not ideal. And when Catherine came and got me and we took a taxi to this hotel, it seemed like utter luxury. Just a big, clean bed to lie down in and sleep and sleep and sleep. I mean, I had vague memories, like, oh, they tell you not to sleep too much if you have a head injury. It's like, I don't care. If I wake up in this world, good. If I wake up in some other world, I'll deal with it. But I slept, and eventually this doctor that Annibale got to come and see us did me some of those scary tests, like, you know, follow the finger and tapping on the knee. And he said, nah, you're okay. You didn't show any brain bleed after the first bit. So you're fine. Go see somebody in a month.
Okay, that's good. So the bump that, I mean, you posted a photo and you shave your head so you can see the bump in all of its glory. And it's literally like the size of a fist in the back of your head. So I assume that was a concussion? At least, I don't know.
I would think. But they didn't use that word with me, and I don't know what the synonym in Italian is. So they did a lot of tests on me, but they were mainly looking for whether the brain is bleeding internally.
Right.
And I think what that feels like, because Mark, as you may remember, long, long ago, like 20 years ago, maybe, I visited you in the winter in Moscow in your first winter there, and I was going to get bread.
Yep.
And nobody had cleaned the sidewalks in a long time.
They never did back then. Yeah.
No, the services were just non-existent.
Yeah.
And
this was 30 years ago, actually.
Oh, 30 years.
It's scary to think so. But yeah, this is when I first moved out to Moscow. Yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't realize that there had been, and this is a real Moscow thing, or at least it was in the days when they didn't de-ice the sidewalks. The sidewalk turns into a kind of ski slope as you go into the street. You know, there's not that sudden break between sidewalk and street. There's a nice little slope that has maybe thawed a bit in the morning. Mm-hmm. And I went right off that and did a perfect slapstick pratfall and landed on the back of my head.
I remember.
And Funnily enough, the worst thing about that in my memory is that when a couple of Russian guys in their, you know, Moscow way grimly picked me up and put me on my feet, I farted. And they expressed their intense disgust for that and let me go. And after that, I was trying to wander back to the apartment. Aminovskaya Chaussee, as
yes,
I recall.
Yes, Aminovskaya, yeah.
And
near the Olympic Village kind of area, yeah.
Yeah, and I could not remember my name or what this world was. I thought, you know, which world is this?
Because it was so otherworldly at that time, and they probably picked you up too quickly, to be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a reason why your brain usually has you sit down for a little bit after that.
But that was the time I knew I had something wrong.
Yes.
Because for 2 months after that, every time I turned my head suddenly, it was like I was on a small boat in a big surf. Everything would rock back and forth.
Definite concussion, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a bad concussion, actually.
And eventually it went away, I suppose, because it was 30 years ago and I was a lot younger and healthier.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we're glad to have you back.
Thanks.
I mean, and thank God you're okay, because we were. Yeah. I mean, when the first couple of days, I mean, I was, and we all were, really worried as hell, because it sounded pretty bad, especially if you were going to have to, if you had brain bleeding and you were going to have some kind of crany something or other, craniotomy, I don't know what they call it, where they drill open your head to relieve the pressure. And it's bad enough in a great first world, you know, rich hospital, but like in Calabria, where you don't know anybody, you guys are all alone, it would be terrifying.
It would have been terrifying. And, you know, I kept thinking of those early civilization surgery techniques where they would chop open somebody's head, supposedly to get the demons out, like, you know, maybe somebody was schizophrenic or something.
Right.
And they said, what we got to do here is we got to chop this big square hole in the guy's head to let the demons out.
Accompanied by like two-dimensional like painting, this very two-dimensional painting of some guy just flat on the ground with blood spurting up out of his head or something, and they remove the top of the scalp.
The finest techniques.
Yes.
And I just didn't want to do that. Even if it was a much better micro drill, I just really did not want to have my precious brain drained like an oil well. I really didn't. Eventually they decided not to do that, and that was a great break. But there's something that I've noticed over time, which is that I have a great capacity for panic in relatively small issues, but when something really horrific happens, I tend to just, I think a lot of people do this, I tend to just blank out.
Yeah. That's a good, I think anyway, it's a good, I don't know, skill or adaptive trait.
Yeah.
It's worked for me really well. I can panic in situations, but in genuinely scary situations, like run-ins with police when I'm when I'm with something that could get me seriously in trouble.
Yeah, I saw one of those and you were amazing, I gotta say.
I don't know why, it's not like I'm consciously fighting with my inner demons. It just happens, sort of like how you said, you just suddenly go blanker and calmer, and it works. It really does work. Anyway, good.
But meanwhile, the good old world has been going stupid and crazy and violent and in its wanted way.
Yeah, you almost want to have your brain drilled after looking at the news for the last couple of weeks. It has been like a brain drill. I mean, I guess, you know, the most obvious thing we need to start with is today the grimmest of anniversaries. Grim because of the, particularly because of what it started. It's the anniversary of the Hamas attack on October 7th, 2023. And the Israeli genocide started while the attack, I mean, I think we can now say, like, while the attack was finishing, the genocide was already starting. And we knew it. We knew it was going to be really bad. I think we even said in those very early episodes where we actually, I took a lot of personal heat from some people I knew, but because we said that it was going to be really ugly, and that the Israelis were going to demand at least 100.
Yep, 101.
101. Yeah. And officially, it's not there, but we all know what the death count is. Probably more like 300 to 400 to 1 is probably what it is. But we won't know that until the hot war part of this, until the actual genocide stops and there is some other ability to, I don't know, to account for what has gone on there. I mean, the Israelis have killed so many journalists that you're not even getting as much social media information out of Palestine.
No,
or Gaza,
and now that TikTok is being taken over by pro-Israel people, that's going to quiet down. I mean, this has been a demonstration of a kind of oligarchical unanimity and like male-fisted dominance that is truly strange. And in fact, I was wondering about that. Like, how come Barry Weiss, just to anticipate our other topics a little bit, how come Barry Weiss has to get appointed, just jumped up about 2,000 ranks from, you know, a wretched subaltern, if not a buck private in the journalism armies, to head of CBS or chief priest of CBS? Yeah. And I wonder if that's like, you guys have been out of control. The public opinion has not been as easily handled as it used to be. We want to rub your noses in it. And there's nothing we can do better than appointing Barry Weiss, who is, I would say, literally one of the stupidest pundits, maybe stupider than Thomas Friedman, in that whole stable of NYT, WAPO, CBS opinion makers.
Yeah, let's get to her in a second. I think first let's just give some of the statistics. It's important. I mean, the most important thing about this genocide really is that it is not to forget, and not to let people forget, not to get distracted, because that is one of the scarier possibilities, is the thought that I don't think people will forget, but it's important not to let them. Anyway, thus far, and this is just according to the Palestinian health, the health ministry in Gaza, 67,173 people have been killed. Among those, 20,179 children and 169,780 wounded. That's just, again, there are probably tens and tens of thousands of bodies buried under the rubble. The rubble looks like nothing from any war we've seen, except like Nagasaki and Hiroshima. But that still represents, you know, even what they're able to count with having had so many of their medical personnel killed. That's, 1,700 medical personnel killed. So that represents killed and wounded that we know of by name. This is only people officially tallied by name. That is about 10% of the population right there. Actually over 10, you know, roughly 10% of the population killed and wounded. Another statistic here. An average of 92 Palestinians killed every day, including 27 children and 14 women. Average of 53 families attacked every day, 4 of them completely wiped out and 8 reduced to a single survivor. Yeah, so,
you know, it's been strange to see these occasional glimpses of Israeli mainstream opinion too. That I think you saw that strange yoga influencer who, in between teaching yoga poses, posted, "Good idea, kill them all." Yeah. It's like, this is yoga? This is you know, the nice yoga lady hippie? But
it's quite scary. And I wonder if this yoga woman was one of these people paid in one of these programs that have been leaked, that is being, you have these influencers being paid, what, $7,000
a tweet? $7,000 a post?
I know.
Wow.
Yeah. That's...
On the one hand, it shows a kind of desperation.
Yes.
In Israeli official circles. On the other hand, $7,000 per post, a post takes maybe 2 or 3 minutes to write at the most. There are many, many people who would kill a stranger for a lot less than that.
Yeah, they're really the people I've seen who look like they're getting that money. They're just loathed people too. They're the types who show off how sort of rich and kind of dolled up they are. They're the kind of people that that are already speaking to their own audience. You know, that are, it's like they're not really persuading middle America. I don't know who they're aiming this at. If it's because those are the only influencers they can find who would be willing to, you know, sully their brand for a long time, or if that's another, you know, some other.
Well, I mean, they're you know, because I do look at posts on creepy sites like Yahoo, and I have surveyed a lot of this, and I think I can see at least two main branches. Well, maybe three. There is a deep, persnickety rage. I don't know how else to put it. A hissy fit rage among Biden Democrats that mere Arab civilians managed to derail their election campaign, Kamala's election campaign, as they see it. And to them, this is, as they would say in that tedious idiom, it's a no-brainer, peculiarly appropriate for them, because it goes without saying that American domestic politics outweigh any number of slaughtered children in Gaza. Because, as I've said before, there were decades devoted to the dehumanization of Arabic-speaking civilians in the Middle East. And that's when you saw how odd it was to people 50 and over that anyone cared about this, like that their kids or their nephews and nieces cared about this. Like, why? It's a plot. It's a Republican plot. Mm-hmm. And then there's this other demographic that has just always hated these people, and they the Arab civilians, in fact, the Arab population of the Middle East. They're often not particularly pro-Israel, but they are violently anti-Palestinian, and they're very willing, I mean, eager to cheer for the destruction of civilian lives there. And then it gets very weird. The surprising thing is there are mostly older American Jews who grew up believing in Israel and can't quite manage to break that umbilical cord. But to the credit of American Jews, many, many fewer than one would think. And many, many Jews have come out against this genocide. So that, you know, there's almost a sense among right-wing commentators who expect that support from American Jews for any retaliation against Palestinians, that somehow American Jews have betrayed them by getting liberal or going soft. But, you know, not entirely. Obviously, Ellison and the other backers who catapulted Barry Weiss into clown princess of CBS still have those loyalties. But I don't know. There are surprisingly many American Jews who are not having any of it.
I'd have to say there's still not enough, though. And I don't mean that to be like, but it's, yeah, it's very hard, especially when you're brainwashed as a Jew, a diaspora Jew, a particular American Jew, brainwashed about, you know, Israel always surrounded by enemies, everybody wants to kill Jews. And this happened after my years that I ever went to synagogue as a kid, but I know that starting, I think, in the 80s and intensified ever since then, there was a real concerted, deliberate effort to make Judaism in America about Israel and the two feeding off each other very deeply. So in that sense, I agree, it's, you know, it's very hard for them to make that break. And it's been generational, like younger ones definitely are breaking more. But look, there's two things I would say. There's a poll that just came out. 61% of American Jews say Israel has committed war crimes against Palestinians. Okay.
I find that a pretty remarkable stat, actually.
I mean, given the brainwashing, I agree. But given the fact that American Jews are generally, you know, overwhelmingly liberal, if it was some other conflict, I think the number would be, you know, higher. But yeah, you're right. I mean, still, it's having to admit something a lot more painful than just, you know, moral stancing. It's having to admit that your family is wrong, or what you perceive and have been brainwashed into believing. My own belief that it was family there was, you know, broken, as I've talked about on the show 30 years ago when I went and visited Israel, and I just realized, like, I have nothing in common with these. Okay, you know, maybe supposedly we have some ethno-religious, I don't really understand ethnic or religious connection, but like, I just came away from my visit to Israel as, oh, I'm a Californian, and this is a totally different foreign country, and that's that, you know? I didn't get the same brainwashing, I don't think, before going there. Even though I was a Zionist before I went there, I just came away as like, foreign country, go back to California. But anyway, 39% of American Jews say Israel's committing a genocide in Gaza. And I mean, that could go both ways. Now, the reality is this is generational. And if you poll, you know, very wealthy, influential Jews, billionaires, media titans, media owners, let's say, the people who really matter because money is power. They're close to 100% pro-Israel and anti-Gaza and anti-Palestine. And we're seeing this in the way they've consolidated under Trump, you know, even more fiercely, basically controlling the media. I mean, this one family, the Ellison family, and they're not the only ones, but the Ellison family has become sort of the front and center of this effort. You know, Larry Ellison, of course.
Do you know what they've been busy doing all this time?
Oracle is huge. I think it was it was software, but then it got into the database industry and data center industry, I should say. And so it's a big part of the whole AI boom, huge part of the AI boom, because it's so big in data storage and data processing is everything now for AI. And AI is like, I don't know if you've seen this, but something like, 60% of investment in America these days is all going into AI. Something like 50% of the stock market boom lately is all just like 7 AI bets on the stock market, and then a few other ancillary bets. Like, it's very, it is like the dot-com boom of the 90s, but maybe even more like the railroad boom, when enormous amount of unnecessary investment. Some of it will pan out, but like, you know, what have we got so far from AI? It's like people are passing around this video. So AI is able to produce this perfect looking video of some disabled Stephen Hawking looking guy in a wheelchair at the top of this massive skateboard ramp. And then they push him down and he goes flipping up and flipping upside down, crashing. And that's the AI generated. And it's like, we have to melt the polar caps and kill off endangered animals so that we can make videos of Stephen Hawking on a fucking skateboard ramp, you know? And that's what's happening here.
I saw that. Oh God.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, so Ellison is the second richest person in the world. But he's been extremely wealthy, you know, like maybe 15 years or more ago, he bought the island. Is it Lanai? One of the little islands in Hawaii. I think it's like the island between Oahu and Maui, maybe. There's like a small island, just turned it into his personal, I'd never seen something like that, preserve. And now, like,
I wonder if he has a defense plan.
Yeah, well, I think they all do. Like, I remember when I was researching Piero Midiar after he bought The Intercept and basically privatized the Snowden leaks, you know, I was investigating him, and he moved to Hawaii too, and he was so paranoid, as one would get from being a multi-billionaire. Why wouldn't you be paranoid? He had all these secret stores deep underground of different foodstuffs awaiting a pandemic. He actually got kind of right, but the kind of pandemic he's been planning for is more of like a SFF, like, you know, a science fiction or video game pandemic, like where literally everybody but you and your... but you and a bunch of hot women die, and then you'll have to repopulate the earth or something, you know? So, Ellison has always, I think, been a supporter of Republicans, and I bet big on Trump. And right after Trump took office, Trump announced this big Stargate project, and it was like going to be the biggest project, you know, since like dwarfing the Manhattan Project, to really defeat China and secure first place in AI, because people in the AI world think it's all about the race and who reaches like, you know, this autonomous generalized knowledge, whatever, learning knowledge point first, and whoever wins, like the game is all over, supposedly. Mm. And so, you know, as soon as Trump takes office, he announces this $500 billion project, Stargate project, led by Larry Ellison, with OpenAI and an Emirates fund, and again, SoftBank is a Japanese investment bank.
Yeah, the Chinese reaction to this is one of those big topics that doesn't get addressed much. There's all sorts of scare stories about what is China doing now. And to the best of my knowledge, China is being very patient and trying not to upset anyone while they watch what is called the West set itself on fire.
Yes. And,
you know, try to keep a smile off their faces.
Yeah, try to keep us, because it's a dangerous time. We're in some kind of crazy decline, and that's dangerous because America's still very powerful. You know, it's lost its shit, but it's still, you know, a fifth or more of the global economy. It still controls global finance, still has this insane military, massive debt that could just sink the whole world, like if the debt blows up. So America's is a very dangerous, crazy person that you don't want to set off. But meanwhile, China's like, they've made advances in the AI race. This is for a different episode, I'm sure, but you know, the DeepSeek project, like they've end-arounded. Because under Biden started basically blockading certain advanced chips and chip technology to China so that we could definitely win the AI race. And they've found ways both to get a hold of those chips, enough of those chips, but also to make slightly less powerful chips work on, like they were forced to innovate.
Right.
With
well,
less.
That's the
and
thing.
That's what they
like,
did.
We've talked about this in the context of the European so-called blockade of Russia.
Yep.
What you're doing is doing one of the few really, and I don't pretend to understand economics, but I would think you're doing one of the few really effective stimulants to improvisation in mm-hmm. what is supposed to be the enemy economy. And do you really want to do that?
I don't think we have any other tricks up our sleeve, though, you know? Yeah. I mean, it's the only way that, you know, we can think. I don't know. It is kind of shocking. I mean, it is a sign of decline. Like, that you have to do that is a sign of decline, and very different from the previous morality, you know, professed morality of the American system, which is, no, everybody, free, fair competition. May the best win, you know, may the best product or, you know, innovator win. And we just said, wait a minute, we could be beat. Okay, rules changed.
Man, that
new
was
rules.
Supposed to be us.
Yeah. Yeah. New rules, dude. So Ellison used the force of the state. Of course, this started with Biden. Again, the squeeze on TikTok. It did start with Biden. The Democrats did back it. Then, of course, just how many own goals the so-called Democrats can do. But eventually Trump did it and forced some kind of deal. We don't know all the specifics of it, but at least the American version of TikTok, or what's going to be seen in America and probably, I guess, other English-speaking countries, is controlled now by oligarch Larry Ellison. And that means that content critical of Israel, critical of the genocide, is going to be massively curtailed. And, you know, they've been, the rich and powerful in this country have been talking about that is TikTok as a problem for the U.S. empire and for Israel. Like, they've been openly talking about that. I think Blinken was talking about
it. I heard a clip of Netanyahu talking about it to friends, and he said, you know, don't be worried about engaging people who've been hostile in the politicians who've been hostile. Talk to them. And it was good advice in a grim way. Mm-hmm. But there's also this sort of sentimental appeal to whatever wavering ethnic identity is still prevalent among American Jews. And I think here there really is a difference between California and maybe, you know, the Acela corridor, because I think California is a pretty potent solvent culturally. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that
But I think it's worked. Generational again. And I think a lot of, like, why do they like Barry Weiss? Why do the Palantirs and the Ellisons, why do they like Barry Weiss? Because they all have these people who are super rich, super wealthy, super powerful, Jews and non-Jews, see their kids in elite colleges, and their kids are either pro-Palestine and against Israel and pissed off as hell about the repression, or they're pissed off at, and they bring this home at, like, you know, the left and the liberals and how the campus is making them feel unsafe for supporting a genocide. You know, they should be able to safely support a genocide and whatever. So they're bringing home rage one way or the other that is transmitting to the parents with the money. And the people with money feel threatened by this. I mean, this is like... we should go deeper to this maybe another time, but the meaning of Israel to the ruling class of this country is something, it's a mystery, it's mind-boggling, it's kind of terrifying.
That makes one connection for me. Like, there's something embarrassing about Barry Weiss. Like, God, she's so slow. She's so... She's so dim and uncool and whatever adjectives were popular when I was young many eons ago. And I think she is reassuring to people's parents exactly. In that way. Like, why don't you be more like Barry Weiss, you know?
Yes, that's exactly it. That's who she talks to. And that contrarianism. So it's like parents who probably were liberals at one time, definitely were liberals, and found it kind of harder to be liberals over time. But the genocide really was an inflection point where you either somehow stuck to your values and you your other side came out. That has been there latent for a long time, and we've seen that. So Larry Ellison's son, of course, David Ellison, owned Skydance. He engineered with, again, the Trump administration's definite help, a merger, basically takeover of Paramount, which owns CBS, and so now Barry Weiss, from the Free Press and from this stupid University of Austin, I think they called it, backed by all these tech oligarchs, is bought out for $150 million. I mean, this is, to me, this looks so much. Before I get in, also, it looks like Ellison is going to be buying Warner Brothers, which means Ellison will also control CNN. On top of Looney Tunes, which I find incredibly offensive.
That hurts.
But, yeah.
That hurts.
But so they'll have just this one oligarch family, CNN, CBS, 60 Minutes, and all the shows, the news shows of CBS, and TikTok. And it reminds me, again, it's sort of Yeltsin-era stuff. I mean, this is just oligarch moves, but whereas the oligarchs took over what was a very lively, wild, pretty free, corrupt but free and great press in Russia that lasted from late perestroika until 95, 96, the year of Yeltsin's election, stolen election in 96 with, the U.S. backing. Then all the oligarchs snapped up all the press, all of the TV channels, all the big newspapers, and
did they? But this is an interesting moment because did they agree to tone it down in their general interest?
The oligarchs?
Yeah, to bland it out.
Yes. So what they did was they did tone it down for the 96 election. They wanted to make sure because they knew Yeltsin he was polling about 3 or 4%. So they knew they were going to.
It was astonishing. Yeah.
So they knew they were going to have to steal it. They knew they were going to steal it. The point was that you have to steal it in a way that is plausible enough that it takes the wind out of the opposition's sails. You got to do it sort of like that. Give it this sense of inevitability. So owning all the press definitely did that. And also having an opposition figure like Gennady Zyuganov, the Communist Party leader. He was, again, one of these like Washington generals type of Communist Party,
He even had that kind of face.
Yes.
It's a grim job, but we have to do it.
Exactly. So, but what did happen, and I think this will happen later, was after they got the election stolen and then then it came time to steal the rest of the country and divide it up between the oligarchs. 97 and Yeltsin was half dead most of the time, and the oligarchs started using their media to try to engineer what they thought they should be able to steal. So they were all stealing. They were all stealing government funds, IMF funds, World Bank. That was one thing, but they wanted assets. And there were some oligarchs who weren't getting enough assets. And so that's when you started having the bankers' wars, as they called it in Russia, and the media turned into a very destabilizing force. It was great from a journalist's point of view, but you had different media outlets dredging up compromise and publishing, or airing on TV compromise against, other oligarchs or their the politicians that fronted for those oligarchs.
Ah, yeah, I remember the El Dorado Hotel case.
Oh, which one was that? I don't even remember that one.
It was a prosecutor who got...
Of course, yes, yes. Yuri Skuratov, yeah. That was an early Vladimir Putin joint. That was when he was FSB chief. That's what got Yeltsin to say, okay, this guy... this guy's good. He can protect me. I'll make him prime minister. So, so anyway, yeah. So, you know, Barry Weiss, you know, here's a quote from her. Oh, no, this is a quote from Frank Luntz. You remember the famous Republican pollster going way back. He said, she doesn't just speak to the 1%, she speaks to the 100th of 1%, and they'll listen.
And he was saying this by way of praise.
I think so. I would assume so, because that's he caters to that crowd too, and he's like, yeah, she's got good game here. I mean, it might not be as easy as it sounds. Like, if you have absolutely no gag reflex, so already that's a skill. Then how do you speak to
them?
Well,
this is what I was saying before, that in some dim way, I get the sense that her own lack of intellectual distinction is a positive.
Yes, totally agree.
These people.
Yes, I remember you made that point in your great review of Thomas Friedman's book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, way back. But, you know, and you said that was the, like, when you have all the power, being dumb, being stupid and deliberately unclever is a way of showing power. You don't need to be clever. You don't need to come up with good
ones. It's the ultimate way of discouraging any intellectual dissent. It's like, fuck.
I don't know. You've probably heard one of her more famous moments when she was on Joe Rogan's show, and she said, Tulsi Gabbard, this is years ago when Gabbard was still, I guess, on the other side. She called her an Assad toady. And somebody said, toady? What's a toady? And she says, you know, toady. I'm not sure. Somebody said, how do you spell it? She goes, I think it's T-O-A-D-I-E. I swear to God.
Hey, toady, you got to smoke?
It's like Dan Quayle level. But, you know, then I guess he would say, who's laughing? I was a vice president.
Right, that's true.
A few other Larry Ellison joints that we know of. He's funding $350 million to the Tony Blair Institute, which is going to be the sort of viceroy in charge of Gaza if this peace plan, the Trump peace plan for Gaza goes through. And it's also just come out that he personally vetted Marco Rubio to make sure that he was properly pro-Zionist, pro-Israel. And, you know, Marco Rubio, I mean, he still seems kind of ridiculous to us, knowing him going back to his silly Tea Party days and just kind of this squeaky dweeb. But he is very powerful. He is both.
Yeah, he doesn't squeak anymore. He has a mean kind of assassin's look.
Yes.
Now.
Yeah, and he's got Venezuela, he's got Maduro. There will be a war against Maduro, some kind of invasion or some kind of stupid plan, but they're going to go kinetic against Maduro and try and take over Venezuela sooner rather than later. But he's, you know, he's Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, which is, I think Kissinger might have been the last person to hold both of those titles. So he's quite powerful. And he's also Larry Ellison's man. I don't know if you wanted to say
it's just rainbows all over the horizon.
I know. I mean, you know, it does seem possible. There does seem to be potentially some momentum for an end to the, I mean, I hate to call it a war, the genocide, really. I mean, Trump seems to have put some verbiage behind it. He said, you know, Hamas responded positively. Hamas was probably smart to not reject it, to say, yes, we accept it. We will do this. We just have to make some adjustments. And I think they're in that stage right now. And so it's sort of like, and then of course, Netanyahu is going to just do all he can to sink anything.
It's hard to imagine any good outcome for Netanyahu. As many people have pointed out, he can survive as long as there's a war. But when peace, if it ever does, descends again, He has a lot of questions to answer.
Yeah. You know, getting back to, I think we should play this clip of Van Jones right now because.
Yeah. That was stunning.
It was stunning. And I'm sure people have heard it, but we need to talk about it again. This needs to be repeated. Van Jones on the Bill Maher show. Van Jones is 57, so he's a Gen Xer, which is still, my generation is also generally does not see Palestinians as people. PEP, progressive except Palestine, is pretty common.
Right.
But Van Jones, being an old Maoist, and like Max Blumenthal was tweeting out, he was at some event with Van Jones where Van Jones was wearing a keffiyeh and gave some kind of tribute to pro-Palestine protesters. This is about 14, 15 years ago. So he knows. He actually knows. He's just a pure opportunist. Brendan, if we could play the clip of Van Jones on the Bill Maher show recently.
Isn't part of that because we had to fold everything into critical race theory and somehow the Middle East became part of,
I see it differently. And I love this conversation because I think people, those of us who went to college, give a lot more credit to college courses for how the world works than I do. This is not about critical race theory on college campuses. This is about Iran. Iran and Qatar have come up with a disinformation campaign that they are running through TikTok and Instagram that is massive. If you are a young person, you open up your phone and all you see is dead Gaza baby, dead Gaza baby, dead Gaza baby,
right.
Diddy, dead Gaza baby, dead Gaza baby. Like, that's basically your whole feed. That's not DEI. That is a geopolitical adversary that is deliberately trying to divide the West against itself.
That view is not
okay.
Yeah, that was stunning. Like Diddy, and they just kill themselves applauding and laughing. But I mean, the worst of that, in some ways, is. Bill Maher trying to be an intellectual, as he always does, trying to conceptualize things in the oldest and most tired way. Like, you know, aren't these kids just trying to blah, 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 blah? And even Van Jones is tired of that. And he wants to say, there, everywhere you look, there's these dead Palestinian kids. Yeah. That's not a painting. Yeah. That's not an imaginary work of art. That's a photograph. And those are all photographs. Does that not make an impact?
And videos. Yeah, I mean, I think we can say, to quote Frank Luntz, he's trying to talk to the 0.01% of the richest people and the most powerful people here. And it does speak to them. Is my guess, because they feel threatened by the possibility that people would turn on Israel. It feels like a lot of things could unwind if this isn't somehow stopped. Just for a little reference here, Brendan, could you play the clip of Van Jones 4 years ago? On the morning, just as soon as CNN called the election for Joe Biden over Trump. Could you play that?
Van, what are your thoughts? It's easier to be a parent this morning. It's easier to be a dad. It's easier to tell your kids character matters. It matters. Telling the truth matters. Being a good person.
Is he crying?
Matters. He's crying. Yeah. For his kids.
And it's easier for a whole lot of people. If you're Muslim in this country, you don't have to worry if the president doesn't want you here. If you're an immigrant, you don't have to worry if the president's going to be happy to have babies snatched away.
Please. Dead baby, dead babies, dead babies, dead baby. Diddy.
Yeah.
Dead babies, dead. Like, it's. It is so sickening, man. It is so sickening.
Yeah, I guess the tears don't turn on for those dead babies.
No. It's all about the children that you can look at.
Wow.
Now. Yeah. Oh, dear. So, yeah, I think on that just nauseating and grim note, and there's more of this going on. I mean, another program that has just been leaked about Israel influencing the data, basically ChatGPT, how the AI thinks in order to make it spit out pro-Israel propaganda when you ask it questions. It's just amazing. And it's amazing where this world's going. John, you should have stayed down. You should have come back.
No, I actually feel in a muted way, welcome back to the land of the living.
Exactly. No, really, though. Welcome back, John. Yeah, and it is this shithole world that has, you know, that's made Radio Warner, you know, the show that it is today. So
we can take these deadites. We can take
yes,
them.
Yes, yes.
With prolixity.
So thank you again. First of all, glad you're back again, John. And thanks again, everybody. Brendan.
Thanks, everybody, for your patience.
Yes. Talk to you again soon. We'll be back for part two of the Barbarossa series soon. So thanks again. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.